DW Spectrum with Connor Dillon and Gabriel Borrowed.
Hello and welcome to Spectrum. My name is Connor Dillon.
And I am Gabriel Borrowed.
And this is our computer and me special.
Personal computer and me.
Yeah, so we're going to be talking about the whole history of computing and how much it has changed, just how incredibly much it has changed, and where we have come to today.
And how fast it is changing, Connor. And who better to talk to, or actually let talk at the top of this show, than someone who might know that, a futurist by the name of Gert Leonhardt.
In a world where everything is connected, where everything is equally excellent, where performance is reaching perfection, there's only one space left to innovate in. You.
And that is not just a turn of phrase there. He's literally saying that there are things to be done digitally inside your body.
Implants. Essentially.
And that's just the beginning of it. And we are going to get there in the future of the show, later in the show.
Hold on, Connor. Yeah, yeah. Let's go back. Let's not talk about the future yet. Let's talk about maybe the building blocks, how it all started with personal computing. And what better place to do that than right here in Bonn?
Now, this is
the Arit Meum.
Something I had no idea existed. It's a side building of a museum, and it's you could walk right past it and never even know what's in there.
No, you would not. It's very nondescript, unassuming, just a building. And
fortunately, we had a guy helping us. His name is Mario Wolfram, who works
at the Arit Meum Museum.
Yeah, who works there and was able to walk us through. I mean, it was a big nostalgia trip for us, but it went even further back than that. Walk us through the history of computing. So, Mario, can you take Gabe and I back to the beginning?
Yeah, where's the oldest one?
The oldest one? The oldest computer that someone would buy for himself at home would be something like this. This machine is called the IMSAI 8080.
It looks like it has no monitor. It has a bunch of blue and red switches and some red lights. That's it. There's nothing else on this thing.
It's a blue square.
Exactly.
What is this blue square, also called the IMSAI 8080, do?
It is a modern computer, but the most basic modern computer imaginable. So you have all the components that a modern computer have, a CPU on a single chip, RAM, motherboards, and the like. But for input, you just use direct binary input, which you use to talk to the CPU using machine language.
Zeros and ones.
Yes. This is what the switches do. Yeah. This is zero. This is one.
So what on earth...
Hold on, Connor. I'm going to go with the elephant in the room question here. Mm-hmm. Where's the screen?
This is the screen. The LEDs.
The red lights?
Yes.
The red light bulb.
The screen?
Yes. A red light means one, and no light means zero. Because everything that the computer does is math in binary, zero and one. So everything that your computer displays can be expressed in zeros and ones if you have enough code. Of course, today's computers with high resolutions, 3D graphics and the like, they would need to display a lot of code. But everything you see in every single screen on every single computer could be expressed in binary code like this.
It's probably difficult, but can you try to compare what this IMSAI 8080 can do versus an iPhone or a new Samsung S10 or what could
what's
do?
On a theoretical level, they both can do the same thing because they only add zeros and ones. But the iPhones can do it a couple of million times faster and with a memory that is a couple of billion times bigger. So it can just work with more complex, bigger, more thought-out programs in a much faster time. By the way, this IMSAI, contrary to the original Altair, actually is kind of known, kind of famous, because it was the computer you used in the movie War Games by Matthew Broderick to hack the Pentagon. So supposedly in the background there's an IMSAI, and this is supposed to be the CPU of his computer that he uses too.
And that was the one that almost set off a nuclear war.
Yes, by playing tic-tac-toe or something.
Is this a game or is it real?
War Games, playing soon at a theater near you. shall we play?
Mario, I'm going to go out on a limb and say that you spent a lot of time looking at computer screens, dealing with computers in your life. One of the common criticisms today is that kids spend too much time looking at their phones or that there's an overusage of computers and computer screens. What do you say to that?
I think the statement is far too broad. I think we need to look at the individual. Because when I was young, there were kids that would spend their entire days watching TV, which I, for example, always found boring. I always sought out interactive ways to entertain myself. So I think with every medium, especially mediums that are easy to access, like TV, the internet streaming, there can be a danger of overuse. But I think there is an institution that could save us from those, and this is what's called parents. I don't really think it's a problem with the media.
So as an expert on the history of computing,
yes,
how far have we come?
Well, once you start thinking about how far computing and electronic computing has come, it just boggles the mind, even at the earliest stages. For example, one of the first computers was called ENIAC, the Electronical Numerical Integrator and Calculator. It was completed in 1946 and I think shut down in 1955. And in this period, it solved more calculations than the entirety of mankind had done up until this point. And this was a very unnecessarily complicated and primitive computer. Ridiculous by today's standards. So even this, to me, is almost unfathomable. And today we're millions, billions of times past this. So we've come far.
So again, that was Mario Wolfram at the Arithmium right here in Bonn, Germany, giving us a walk through the history of computing, their personal computing.
How many computers do you think were in that room that he took us through?
More than 100. And for both Gabe and I, we grew up looking at some of those computers, playing games on some of those computers.
My first feeling when I saw a couple of the old Apples was going into the computer lab in third grade. We had them all lined up and playing those games. And that noise of that disc ejecting.
That, disc.
That really, I haven't heard that in
my childhood.
Years.
That's the sound of part of my childhood.
Now, many thanks to Mario Wolf.
Yeah,
there.
And I know Mario was saying that you do have to differentiate between different kinds of screen time. I personally feel he's right in that sense. That said, there is a very worrying trend. Now, I have quite a few printouts here with me, Gabe. I don't think you've seen any of them.
I didn't know about this.
So these are various studies about screen time. These have all come out within the last year. A lot of these are based on smartphones, smartphone usage. It's not just limited to that. So one study I'd like to go to immediately comes out of Canada, which showed that the major finding was that children who are glued to their screens are showing delays in key skills.
What skills?
So kids who spent a lot of time looking at screens at age 2 scored worse on a developmental test at age 3, and it just got worse the older they got. The thing that jumped out at me about that study, again from Canada, 2-year-olds spend an average of 2.4 hours a day looking at screens.
No.
3-year-olds, 3.6 hours a day looking at screens. I know. There are a lot of questions. Look, we're not getting into the methodology. These are just printouts that I'm going to throw like frisbees. There goes that one. Okay, so that's one of them here.
Okay.
Another one out of the UK. This was from the British Journal of Ophthalmology, urging children to play outdoors, which is always a good thing, to cut the risk of short-sightedness. So again, they're looking at so many screens, tablets, which are just a few, I don't know, a foot in front of their face, not very far, to please go outside and get some fresh air and look at things that are far away. Gonna frisbee that one aside. Another study, again, these are all from like the last 18 months, that smartphone dependency is linked to reduced relationship satisfaction in college students. So if you're in a relationship with another person, the more time you spend on your phone, it could lead to reduced satisfaction, or the more time your partner does. This one, sleeping with the frenemy, how restricting quote-unquote bedroom use of smartphones impacts happiness and well-being. And one of the highlights from this study, not using smartphones in the bedroom increases happiness and quality of life. Also, smartphones can prevent parents from cultivating feelings of connection with their children. I would toss that one in the category of things we already know. mm-hmm. right? If you're looking at your phone, you're not talking to your kids. Teens are sleep deprived, says this study, and screens are why.
Mm-hmm.
Brain drain. The mere presence of one's own smartphone reduces available cognitive
either,
capacities.
Either studies just really don't like smartphones, or these things are horrible for us.
It seems that there's a lot of concern.
There's got to be a bias going on here, right?
There's got to be a concern. No, and there must be.
I mean, as Mario Wolfram said, it seems too general to make these bland blanket statements about smartphones
yeah.
being bad.
Well, and let's be clear here. Smartphones have existed since 2007, I believe, the first iPhone, if I'm getting that date correct. Anyway, about then. So we, in a way, science is finally catching up to a product that has been around for about a decade, really, mm-hmm. In many people's pockets. Lot of negative stuff about this.
Let's get to a scientist. Our colleague Charlie Shield spoke with, what was it, an eye neurobiologist?
Yeah, let's go ahead and take a break just for a second here while we get Charlie in the studio.
Hey, Charlie.
Thanks for having me.
Now, Charlie, you had an interview this week, and it was with a scientist or with a researcher. It's related to smartphones. But before we get into that, I wanted to ask you, what is your relationship like with your smartphone?
It's one of dependency. I use it all the time. It's probably the last thing I look at before I go to sleep and the first thing I see when I wake up as well.
Are you happy with your relationship with your smartphone?
I'm okay with it, yeah. I think I would really struggle without it to find my way around and to see people on a regular basis. But I think it's okay. I've purposely deleted some social media apps off my phone so I don't use them.
Has it changed you?
The social media deletion?
No. Your dependency on your phone that probably wasn't there a few years ago. You're a different person now.
No, I think it was there because I grew up with it. So, you know, I'm a millennial. Are you guys millennials?
Technically. No, you must be if I am. Technically, I'm on the cusp between millennial and Generation X.
I might be a millennial, but I don't feel like one.
Okay.
How's that?
Sure.
Well, I feel like one. And I've had one since I left high school, I guess.
Okay. So this has always accompanied you and you feel dependent on it, but it doesn't feel like an unhealthy addiction.
No, it doesn't. I mean, sometimes it does, but then, you know, I try to address it.
Okay. You mentioned the last thing you look at before you go to sleep, and that is directly tied to the interview you had this week. Who did you talk to this week, and what was the issue?
I talked to a bloke called Frank Schaeffel. He's a professor of eye neurobiology at the University of Tübingen in
Southwestern Germany, yeah, Baden-Württemberg.
In Southwest Germany. And I asked him about how screen time affects our eyesight.
Okay. And is this a personal question for you? Are your eyes beginning to fail you?
No, they're not, thankfully.
Okay.
But I have had experiences in the past where I've been concerned. So it's definitely something that I was curious about, that I wanted answers to.
Okay, so screen time, computers, mobile phones, tablets, even TVs.
Yep.
What did he say?
Well, the answer might surprise you. He said that it's actually not the screen that's dangerous, but the fact that it draws your attention for long periods of time. So you could actually swap out the screen, whatever it may be, a smartphone, tablet, computer, for a textbook. And if you're looking at it, at a close distance for a long period of time, you would encounter the same problems with your eyesight. He also said that there's a difference between the size of the things you're looking at. So a book is probably takes up smaller...
Definitely.
Dimensions. Space, yeah.
Yeah. So a book is smaller than a computer screen. So also, like, your peripherals, like, you're probably looking around a little bit more than a computer screen, which has sort of, like, absorbed quite a big, like, dimension of your view.
There are glasses out on the market that can apparently stop or mitigate or do something to change the way the blue light affects me. Like if I want to look at my smartphone right before bed, I can put glasses on now. Does that work?
You can don a pair of yellow spectacles.
Yellow spectacles.
Yellow tinted.
And this is what the researcher also said. He said that that this works.
Well, he said to a point. So if you are worried about the blue light disrupting your sleeping pattern, then you can either put on these yellow tinted glasses or use one of the apps that you can get on your phone to change the color of the light that is emitted from blue to yellow. And that could help. But he said he hasn't seen a lot of data, a lot of research behind it.
I like the idea of the yellow tinted glasses.
I can imagine.
What happens with those spectacles on? Is there something being filtered out?
It's the blue light.
Blue.
So with the yellow, you're filtering the blue. And
I don't even like them for that reason. I like the idea of Gabe lying in bed and his wife comes in and sees him wearing yellow tinted glasses while he's looking at his phone before he goes to sleep. You'd look like you'd walked right out of the 70s.
They're actually, yeah, quite funny looking if you've seen them online. They kind of look like the carpenter kind of like.
Yeah, or those glasses that you put on after you've had some sort of eye surgery.
Yeah, so.
Could I? I'm going to roll in here one of these days, I'll tell you.
Wearing some of those glasses. Right. Anything else that he said we can do, to help our eyes?
He said that if you just look around, it'll help you. So don't get locked to one viewing point for hours on end. Look up from your computer or phone, whatever it is. Have a look around. Get up and go for a walk. I guess this is also tying with research that's come out about sitting down too much. So the idea is to sort of just like get up, have a look around, and sort of change what you're looking at.
Okay, so bottom line, broaden your horizons, right?
Wow, that's very deep. Yeah, to avoid myopia, nearsightedness in the long term. Charlie, thank you for joining us in studio today. And let's talk in a few minutes about getting those glasses.
Yeah, let's get a pair.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much, Charlie.
Excited to see you wearing them.
In a world where everything is connected, where everything is equally excellent, where performance is reaching perfection, there's only one space left to innovate in. You.
Okay, so it is time.
Gert Leonhardt. I have been waiting this entire show
for Gert Leonhardt.
For this interview.
We have Gert Leonhardt on the line. And just real quickly, Gert has a background in music, in theology, and for the latter part of his career...
He's a futurist.
...has been listening to things, as he put it. Gert, my first question for you is, what comes after the smartphone?
Yeah, I think the scary part is, of course, that computing is becoming invisible. So now we're already on the verge of this idea of speaking to computers, like, you know, using intelligent assistants and Google Home systems and Amazon, what have you, using all of that stuff where we can speak to a computer like it's a person. And so the next step is that the mobile phone is being absorbed into our environment, for example, onto our wristwatch or onto our eyeglasses. And then next, of course, augmented virtual mixed reality, you know, products that we can wear that allow us to become virtually connected with our eyesight, not just with our screens. And then after that, the brain-computer interface, which you now have for fighter pilots, for example, but it's essentially allowing us to direct things with our brain, this idea of having a direct interface without having a screen.
So what you're saying is essentially then the phone is going to become part of us.
Yes, well, I think that the disembodiment of connectivity, so that we don't necessarily have to have a physical object, we can have that anywhere, it could be our belt, it could be our, you know, cochlear implant even, right, to connect us to the internet. And that's quite clearly becoming possible now that these devices have the computing power of the same machine that brought the Americans to the moon. And in 10 years, they'll have an IQ of a million. So they can be virtual, they can be in the cloud. I can just speak to my device and it will connect me to the entire universe, you know, through my wristwatch. And that's becoming technically feasible with 5G networks and, you know, quantum computing next 10 years, roughly.
When you look ahead to these new disembodied computing technologies, what are some of the risks you see in advance?
Well, it's quite clear that, you know, we are we're moving ahead much quicker than any of our social or ethical or cultural concerns can keep up with, and of course legal concerns as well. So we are already at the point to where we kind of feel like the mobile phone is our second brain. You know, our dating, our music, our news, our banking, everything is in there. And the danger is that we forget who we are, because we can outsource everything. So, you know, I have my digital assistant that will book the airline ticket for me. It will arrange for flowers for a funeral. It will write a notification to my wife that I want to get divorced. All of those things sounds like science fiction. It's already here, right? And so the difficult part is that we're getting deeper and deeper into converging with technology. And the theme in my book is that I say, now we need to embrace technology because that's our progress, but we should not become technology. Like the moment that I get out of bed and I can't do anything until I wear the device that connects me to the network, that's the day that we're going to be saying we're no longer just human. You know, we are like a morphed entity. And that's the day I worry about.
That book that you just mentioned there, Technology Versus Humanity. Why versus?
I think the real message of the book is that it can be versus if we are not careful, but it can also be a really, really powerful aid for us to reach a different level of living, a different level of convenience, of course, but also a certain level of happiness, because it gives us access to free phone calls and free media and all these things. And we're all living longer because of this technology. So it's all good, but we should not go beyond a certain point of it becoming indispensable to being human. So if I need to have a connection so I can have a relationship, for example, with language translation or so, then that would be a very strange thing. If I didn't have the connection, I couldn't exist. Right? And so the theme of the book is that really it should be humanity on top of technology.
Your reservation there that we might forget who we are. What does that mean? I mean, what is the essence of humanism or humanity for you?
Well, if you look at the greatest example is social media today, right? We can pretend that we are anyone on social media. We can also not actually discover what is real for us because the algorithm is feeding stuff back to us that makes us stay the longest wherever we are on social media, right? And the whole thing is an engine, you know, it's an algorithmic system. And if you're looking at the reality of what matters for people, it's not algorithms, it's not data, it's not information, it's not technology, it's engagement, relationships, feelings, emotions, what I call in the book the andro-rhythms, you know, compassion, empathy, spontaneity, intuition, imagination. That's really what drives us. And then if we substitute that because it seems so powerful, but in the end it's empty. You know, you have the biggest, the highest suicide rate in the world is given by those people who are the power users of social networks. I mean, that's the ultimate paradox, isn't it? And so that is the thing that worries me about this, that we would get too lazy and too compliant, and we would basically say, okay, no need to do it ourselves because, you know, my machine can do that for me.
A lot of our listeners don't necessarily want to become part of this machine. They don't want to become integrated into computers themselves. What is your tip for helping them avoid that kind of future, for keeping their humanity in this kind of world?
Well, I mean, there's a bunch of things I think that over the years I've looked at and as things are getting progressively more intense with technology. First, I think we have to keep spaces that are only ours, you know, what I call human only. And so this is like, you need to keep spaces where you are devoid of this technology. And sometimes I say jokingly, offline is the new luxury. You go to a place where that doesn't exist. You go to a place where you go out for dinner, you leave your phone at home by purpose, right? You agree on what the rules are for having dinner together with those devices or not. And there's been lots of research showing that just having the mobile phone next to you on the table when you're having a conversation or dinner, you know, that influences the conversation even if you are not using it. Right? So put it away, put it in the pocket. Right? Monitor your screen time.
Gerrit, thank you very much for giving us a view of a very uncertain future, I think, for a lot of people.
and especially as the pace of technology seems to accelerate.
Gert Leonhard, I have never spoken with a futurist before, so now I can check that box off my list.
All right, thanks very much. See you down the road.
Chance with Gert to answer, or to rather ask, all the questions we wanted. And with that in mind, we're gonna pull out our list of songs, or rather our list of questions that we didn't ask Gert that we wanted to ask Gert. Gabe, here's one for you. If I can sleep in my self-driving car, or let's say it's a self-driving van with a kitchen and a chemical toilet in it, when does it stop becoming a self-driving car and start becoming a self-driving home?
Chemical toilet?
What did you want to ask, Gert?
I want to ask something about your question just now. What's a chemical toilet?
It's so you don't have to, you know, pump the sewage out of it. It's a portable
toilet.
So
it just neutralizes the smell.
Yeah. What did you want to ask?
My daughter, Heidi, was born this past Monday. She will most likely live in the 22nd century. I should have asked Garrett. Will she be happier with whatever implants are going to be implanted into her brain, her body?
Or which ones,
body?
Yeah, which ones would make
her
happy?
No, are they going to make her happier than she would have been if she had lived now?
So we started to talk to this about Garrett a little later after I called him on the phone. It was about music. And one question I didn't ask him, I wish I'd asked him. Artificially intelligent music software will write beautiful music in the very near future. In fact, it's already starting to do so. So, will they write a song like this? And if they did, would it matter that a computer wrote it? Does it change how you listen to it? Does it change how you perceive that music? Also, what will the
Let me ask a question. What is going to be served for lunch next week here at Deutsche Welle?
I think not. You don't need a futurist for that one. You can talk to the chef down there. I was going to ask, what will the weather be like on Friday, April 25th, 2042? Because maybe I'll want to go for a walk that day. And actually, maybe the better question is, when will I know in advance what the weather is going to be like on that day? Will it be in 2042?
Oh, so will that knowledge be inside your brain? Maybe you can control the weather by that point.
Another question. Is this a simulation? Are we inside a simulation, one of billions, trillions, quadrillions of simulations?
Didn't Leibniz answer that?
Don't know.
This is not the best of all possible worlds. We are not monads, Connor.
I'm not sure I know what a monad is. But one thing I know... We've had a lot of people help us out on this show, so many special thanks to Mario Wolfram at the Arrhythmium in Bonn, to Charlie Shield, our DW colleague, to our studio technician, Gert Georgi, thank you very much.
And of course that other Gert Leonhard, the futurist. Thank you to Zurich, where he's based.
And again, a special thanks to all of our listeners out there for going on this journey with us. If you have any questions about the future...
Send them to us.
Send them in.
Spectrum@dw.com. I swear to God, we'll read these emails. And we will think about your questions for you and possibly talk about them on the air at some point later.
And on that note, from Gabe and I and all of us here at DW, have a wonderful week ahead. Mm-hmm.